You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones. And in this episode, I sit down with filmmaker and skate legend Stacy Peralta. Stacy Peralta recalls his earliest and most visceral memories of skateboarding as the rumbling of the sidewalk coming up through his feet. Metaphorically, what he might have been feeling was the oncoming explosion of skateboarding, which would carry him to places he couldn't imagine as a grade schooler on his inaugural ride down an especially smooth stretch of Venice Boulevard in Southern California. By age 17, he was inventing iconic tricks and earning more money than his parents as a skater. And by age 19, he was the sport's highest-ranked pro. His skate team, Powell Peralta, launched the careers of legends like Rodney Mullen, Steve Caballero, and Tony Hawk. His Bones Brigade video show virtually invented the skateboard video, creating the sport's first marketing vehicle and enabling kids worldwide to see the sport's best athletes up close and personal. And for his next trick, Peralta walked away from it all. Peralta abandoned what had been his whole identity to attempt a writing and directing career in film and television. This leap of faith is even braver in light of his own complete lack of confidence in his chances of succeeding. And his fear seemed justified by an initial run of projects that Peralta says just got worse and worse. But because doing anything else seemed even more impossible, he did succeed. His documentary, Dogtown and Z-Boys, premiered at Sundance, winning the Documentary Directing and Audience Awards, and eventually selling over 1 million DVD copies. His film, Crips and Bloods, Made in America, won acclaim as a hard-hitting and thoughtful look at the circumstances that led to the creation of two of the most violent gangs in U.S. history. Peralta talks about weathering the highs and lows of a truly remarkable career and tells off camera that for the first time in 15 years, he doesn't know what he's going to do next. Whatever it is, have faith, it'll be rad. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Stacy Peralta.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, man, it's nice to be here.
Well, I've wanted to get you on here since the first episode, you know. You're a hard man to get hold of. But let's jump right in. I wanted to ask you about the first time you ever stepped on a skateboard. What year was that?
I don't really know exactly what year it was. All I know is my grandmother lived about 3 miles from us. I grew up in Mar Vista. And my mom would go over there every day to visit her, every single morning. And there was an older kid across the street who had a boxcar skateboard scooter. And I remember going over there one day and riding that down the street, riding it down the sidewalk. First time I ever did it. But the first time I actually remember getting on an actual skateboard was on Venice Boulevard. At Sentinel in Venice, there was this Steve's Rexall Drugs. And it had one of those really wide band sidewalks around the perimeter of this building. A friend of mine's older brother had a skateboard that he had let go after 63 or 4, whenever the boom happened. I took the skateboard, we went down there, and I remember rolling down this perfectly graded sidewalk, okay? And I had a profound realization, because when you're on a bicycle, you hold on to handlebars and you sit on a seat. It's very secure. It's very, very secure. When you're on a skateboard, you hold on to nothing. You're standing there, it's very insecure. And I'm rolling down this sidewalk. I can feel the rumble coming up from my feet of the sidewalk. There's the wind's blowing my hair. I realize at any moment I can fall and really hurt myself. But at the same time, there was this sense of stillness that came to my gut, that amongst all this chaos, I'm completely still right now. And I just fell in love with that feeling. That feeling of being in complete chaos, but there's complete peace within me.
So you remember that?
Oh, totally. Because I've always been in search of it. Yeah, every time I get on a skateboard, I'm in search of that peace. I'm more relaxed on a skateboard than I am standing or sitting or doing anything. My body just goes...
To this day. Amazing.
Yeah, to this day.
So were you what? 6, 7, 8?
I was probably six when that happened. When I was at my grandmother's house riding the scooter, I was probably 3 or 4? 4 probably?
No kidding.
4 or 5? Something? I don't know. I just remember it happening.
Right.
So it's hard to say which year.
And when you started,
Washington had just crossed the Potomac when I had ridden my scooter for the first time.
People don't know skateboarding's been around that long. You know what I mean? Had you heard of backyard pool skating at that point, or that?
There was no such thing as backyard pool skating when I was a kid. No such thing. There was no such thing as skateboard parks. The only thing that existed that we understood outside of sidewalks, which we skated on every single day, was that in LA we had a collection of school playgrounds that had banked walls like asphalt waves. And those existed in Los Angeles, and they didn't pretty much exist anywhere else in the world. I've been all over the world, and I've never seen anything like what we had in Los Angeles. At Paul Revere, at Bellagio, at Mar Vista School, at Brentwood Elementary, and there was one more that I'm forgetting right now.
That's
but
interesting.
But it was literally like growing up in Los Angeles was like having five or six of the greatest golf courses in one city. And outside of that city, there's no other golf courses.
Huh.
And that's all there was.
That's true.
If you wanted to take skateboarding beyond sidewalks, these schools were the only place you could go.
It's funny, because I always assumed as a kid, because I skated, and there were banks everywhere. Like, there was in Fullerton, there was the Acacia School banks. There was Flower Street, which mm-hmm. is a great ditch. Mm-hmm.
But you only find these in California for the most part.
That's what's interesting, because I always just figured, oh, there must be these scenes Mm-mm. going on in different...
No, they didn't. I traveled off across Europe. I traveled across Australia. Never saw anything like this. I've traveled across America, and I've never seen anything like this. But not only that, then you go to the swimming pools, which blew up in the 70s. In the 70s, the greatest swimming pools on Earth were in Southern California. And the reason that they were is because that's where the movie star pools were. The pools we rode were from the movie star pools. They were all in Beverly Hills and the San Fernando Valley where rich people lived. And the rich people wanted to emulate the pools that Marilyn Monroe had and that all these famous actors and actresses had. And so there were these big voluptuous shapes that you didn't see in perhaps San Francisco or San Diego. Certainly not in any other states.
Right.
Like you'd go to Florida and you'd ride their pools. They were terrible. But this existed in Los Angeles. So the skateboarders in LA, we were able to take advantage of so many things that didn't exist anywhere else, the bank playgrounds and the movie star swimming pools.
Who thought of first going in a pool, do you know, to skate?
I don't know.
I
remember being at the Zephyr shop one day and somebody came in and said, hey, there's an empty pool in Brentwood. That was it. There's an empty pool in Brentwood. That's all we heard. Okay, we got to find out where this pool is. We found out where it was, and we rode it for the first time.
And what was that like, the first time you skated in a pool? Like, describe that experience.
Well, the weird thing was it was a pool made in the 1920s, and we called it the bird bath because it looked like a gigantic bird bath, meaning that it wasn't vertical. It was slopey, like this. You could go back and forth, but it was a strange slope. There's no coping. And it was extremely old style, but you had a lot of room from the shallow end to push in. And we could carve and kick turn and do the whole thing. In fact, in my very first Who's Hot in Skateboarder magazine, it shows me getting an aerial out of this thing. I didn't make it and I wasn't trying to do it, but I'd come out of contact.
Really?
Next pool we rode was in Upper Santa Monica and it was called the Rabbit Hole. And it was a tiny little pool that to this day is one of the most dangerous pools I've ever ridden in my life.
Because it was so steep.
It was so small and steep and tight. And then after that, it was like, it seemed like every week there was a new pool being discovered. There was all of a sudden Beverly Hills and then the Valley and then Pomona. There was all these pools all over the Southland.
And when that happened, was that a whole like mind-blowing thing to go from banks and streets and stuff and all of a sudden, was it all you wanted to do was find the perfect pool?
Oh my God, we were in search of pools. We would drive to Arizona to find a pool. We would drive to Palm Springs. We would drive to the desert, Indio County. We would hear these rumors of a pool in San Francisco. We'd drive. We'd go there to ride these pools. I once made a list. In 1978, I made a list. I wrote about 120-something pools in a two-year period. Can you imagine that?
Wow. They were all empty.
But I wrote 120 empty pools. All illegal, all empty at that time. And of course, the reason we were able to do this is because the drought that happened to Los Angeles in California at the time, where the city government said you're not allowed to fill your pool if it doesn't already have water.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. So if a house was up for remodel and they emptied their swimming pool, they could not refill it until the drought was cured. So that's why there were so many pools that were empty. There were billboards in Los Angeles at that time that were encouraging married couples to shower together because that water crisis was so bad.
Really?
Yeah.
That is
so funny. So the drought helped us, in a sense, develop professional skateboarding. The timing was right. The urethane wheel changed everything. It made it possible for us to do something that we previously could not do under any circumstances. You couldn't ride pools with rock wheels, with clay wheels. It would have been too hard. Plus, with the trucks and the boards that we used to ride before they started making professional equipment, it would have been impossible. We would have been so banged up. But the urethane wheel really made it possible. And the new trucks, and the new bigger boards and everything. Right. It was a combination of a lot of things coming together at one time that made it possible. But those of us who lived in the Santa Monica, LA area, we had entree to the best terrain in the world in excess. In excess. Just, it was constantly unfolding in front of us.
And did your parents have any idea what you were doing with your afternoons?
You know, I don't remember, man. I guess my luckiest thing is my parents were liberal enough to let me do what I was doing. They looked at me and they said, I think I always had a job. I always worked. And I think they figured that I was a responsible kid and I was taking care of business. And as long as I did that, they let me do what I needed to do. Like if a swell came up, like a really big freak swell came up, I would ask my mom if I could cut school. I'd say, look, there's a really great swell. It's on Wednesday. Would you let me take school off to do that? And she'd say, let me see your grades. I'd sure go, all right, you can do that. And by giving me that freedom, I didn't want to screw up. I didn't want to be bad. I wanted to, like, you know, my parents are being good to me. I'm gonna be cool about this stuff. So I kept my screw up stuff to a limit.
That's interesting. And but that's giving you freedom is different than maybe today's parents of supporting. Like
I didn't get support.
Tell me about that.
I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean it like, okay, let me ask you this much. How old are your kids?
My kids are 6, 7, and
okay.
14.
When your oldest kid is 18 years old, imagine what you would think if your kid spent 6 hours a day jumping up and down on a pogo stick.
You'd think he was just a freak.
Right. Well, my parents had absolutely no reason to believe that I wasn't wasting my life riding a skateboard. The neighbor kid's parents thought I was. There was one neighbor kid, the parent in the neighborhood said, I don't want you playing with that kid across the street because he's going to waste his life on that skateboard.
But because at some point that must have shifted, right?
But there was no precedent to why a kid should spend time on this. It was considered a waste of time. But when I started making money, then it was looked at as, they were proud of me, but it's like, how is this possible?
Right.
I was making more than my parents at one point. And they were middle class people, both with jobs. And at one point, I was making more than they were. I was 17 years old.
Do you remember that conversation at the dinner table?
Didn't have a conversation. It was just like, let me see the check you just got. And they'd look at it and go, I know they were wondering, how long can this last?
Right.
You know,
right.
What is this? And so, and then I went to tour Europe, and I remember I got off the plane in England. We landed on the tarmac. They put the staircase up to the tarmac. I walked down the tarmac holding my skateboard in England. And there's photographers down at the bottom of the stairs waiting for me. Waiting for me. I'm a 17-year-old kid, and I'm being treated like a rock star in England. First time I've ever been outside of the country.
Amazing.
And they say, get on your skateboard, ride your skateboard. So I rode my skateboard down the tarmac, and I got arrested.
You got arrested?
Yeah. So my parents the next day read in the LA Times, they open the paper up, and there it says, you know, Stacy Peralta, you know, 17-year-old skateboarder from America is arrested, you know, getting off the plane in England. And that's, you know, my parents would see stuff like that, and that's the stuff that would connect with them. They go, wow, this is really something.
Wow, wow. You know? And you actually got out of it at a fairly early age. Like compared to now where you can see guys having longer careers, you made a shift at a fairly young age from skating for a living to becoming a team manager. And you started...
Yeah, but that's only because all my generation was ending. It was like, if you really look back in skateboarding history, we got 2.5 years being professional skateboarders. Our careers were over before they even began. I'm serious.
Just because of the fad ended? Or
yeah, the fad ended and it was over with. Skateboarding crashed in 1980, 81.
Right.
And we were forced to leave. But with me, because I was now working with a company that was my own, I could earn my living by working as opposed to by skating.
How did that happen that you
I could see the writing on the wall.
You did.
I started seeing that there's big changes here. I've got limited time at what I'm doing right now. And I started asking the company that I was with, Gordon & Smith, if I could build a future with them. And there was no future there that I could build. And so I started talking to different manufacturers about, hey, look, I want to be a part of a company.
Where do you think that came from? That come from your parents at all?
It came from total fear.
Really?
Because I thought I was going to have a really lame life.
So you saw...
Lame as in really uneventful... I'm probably going to be in the labor force as some sort of a builder, you know, some sort of a tradesman. I didn't want that. I didn't want that at all. I didn't do bad in school, but I didn't do anywhere near what you would give you the self-esteem to believe that you could do more. And my parents couldn't afford to send me to college, so I knew that wasn't an option. And so I was like going, man, what am I going to do with my life? And that was my ticket. That was it. That was it.
But I can imagine, so you get with George Powell and you have the name and you guys make it Powell Peralta, but then skateboarding dies. So at one point are you sitting there in a room looking at each other like, how are we going to make this work?
Yeah, it was a really rough time from 1981 to 84. There were times where we almost went out of business. There were times where George had to borrow money from his father to make payroll at the company. I remember driving to the company one time, literally looking at the stars at night going, am I fooling myself thinking that we can make this into a business? It was slim pickings, man. It was a really, really, I was doing something I believed in, but it just didn't exist. Didn't exist anymore. You know, and it was scary. And when it started, but the good news is that we were able to reinvent what we wanted skateboarding to be. Because in the 70s, skateboarding was freestyle, it was slalom, it was downhill, and all these other things. But what it really wanted to be was vertical skateboarding, mm-hmm. and then eventually street skateboarding. And so when skateboarding died in the early 80s, we then took it to the backyard ramps, and we made skateboarding a very unprofessional activity. A professional, unprofessional activity. And that was a really fun thing to be a part of, to building that. It was really fun to be on the ground floor of street skating, to see that and realize we've got to promote this thing.
Yeah. That was my main years were the worst years. So it was all...
81, 2, 3?
I skated, 81 through about 87 and was on a shop.
Oh, 85, 86, 87 were great.
They were great, but before that it was contested backyard ramps.
Yeah.
It was, I would do freestyle contests just because there was a contest and street skating. And, but I remember being at some of these contests.
But for you, it must have been so much fun.
Oh my God.
That was such a good time.
It was such a, well, I wanted to ask you about that. If looking back, even though there was all the fear of the business, I look at that as such the golden era of skating.
Oh, it's amazing.
When you go to Upland and there was a contest and there was 100 people watching at the most, mm-hmm. and yet the talent was amazing.
Amazing. Amazing. The talent was amazing. And not only that, we were witnessing at that time the birth of real vertical skateboarding. When you saw Steve Caballero and Mike McGill and Christian Hosoi and Lance and all the guys back in the early 80s, they had taken vertical skateboarding from us, my generation, and they really developed it into what it was going to become. Acrobatic, flying through the air, where my generation looked at the wall and go, how can we draw a line on the wall? These guys said, we're not even going to deal with the wall anymore. We're going to do everything in the air. Everything's going to be in the air. We're not even going to do anything here anymore. And that was a paradigm shift. And they developed that all in a vacuum. I mean, McGill invented the McTwist in 85.
That's amazing.
1985.
Now,
Rodney Mullen invented the Ollie in 83. It's incredible what took place at that time.
Yeah, it's such a great period of, and when it's going on, you just see it like anything else.
Yeah.
But looking back.
But I had pressure at that time because I had to make a business work. And I also had to make a future for myself work. And I was like going, man, am I wasting my time on something that's never going to happen? As much as I was interested in it and loved doing it and was inspired by it, I was also going, God, am I going to find myself at 30 just, you know, in a no-win situation? It was that tricky.
Yeah.
You know? But when I remember the first time it started to come back, in 1985, I had just come back from the Tahoe Ramp Backyard Contest. Mm-hmm. I walked into George's...
Terror at Tahoe.
Yeah. I walked into George's office and he hands me an envelope. And he goes, go ahead and open it. I go, what is it? He goes, just open it. And this is after I've done the very first skateboard video. I open it and it's a check for 15 grand. Okay? Today, not such a big deal. Back then, it was gigantic. He goes, that's a bonus. He goes, the business is really coming back.
Wow.
And that was the first time in 4 years that I'd made any money. I existed on $1,000 a month for all those years. It paid all my bills up to like a dollar.
Amazing.
Yeah, $1,000 a month.
I had Tony Hawk here, and he described for me the moment when he was at Kona, and you came to the park with some early members of the Bones Brigade, mm-hmm. whether it was, you know, I
sure,
think
it was Del Mar.
Maybe it was Del Mar, not Kona, but he was describing that the atmosphere changed at the park, and he described it as though Elvis had entered the room. And, oh my gosh, Stacy's here, and he's going to see me skate. And it got me thinking, you know, what your impression of seeing Tony skate for the first time was. Do you remember that?
I don't remember seeing him the first time, but I remember seeing him a lot back then. And he was really, really, he was not an impressive skater at that time. He was tiny, he was extremely thin and very weak, and he had a hard time getting up to the top of the pool. But I watched him month after month, and you could just see that this kid had an amazing determination. And he did tricks that were kind of beyond his ability, and they were tricks that he invented. And you could see, like, this kid's doing something unusual. He's a thinker. And as I've said many times before, he was never satisfied with what he was doing. You could just see it in him. And I realized this kid's going to become something. But I didn't, at that time, know that he had the potential to be what he would become until 1984.
Well, but you offered him a deal before then.
I did. He got on the team in 1981 or two, maybe 81. I lost Christian Hosoi. I was sponsoring Christian Hosoi. I lost him. And I had to fill the space, so I picked up Tony Hawk. It was a good trade. But anyways, in 1984, I go down to Del Mar Skateboard Park to shoot Tony for the very first skateboard video that we made, Bones Brigade Video Show. And Tony's doing tricks I've never seen anybody do in my life, ever. He's doing the airwalk, mm-hmm. which is a stunning trick when you've never seen it before. And he's doing the finger flip backside air. What he was doing was so incredible. I remember taking him to lunch that day, and he had had a lot of contest trouble up until that time. He had turned professional, but he wasn't doing well. He wasn't succeeding professionally. He was stumbling. If he rode Del Mar, he won. Take him outside of Del Mar, he couldn't do anything. He just crumbled. But after that day of shooting him that day, we went out to lunch, and I sat across from him at this coffee shop, and I said, you know what? This is your moment. I go, next year, you're going to be able to win every single contest you enter.
What made you say that to him?
I could just see it in him. He had developed strength. He had gotten bigger. And he was skating in a way that he was commanding what he was doing. He was taking real control. And he had figured out a way to do aerials as high as everyone else, but not the conventional way. Everyone at that time, when they hit the top of the pool, they'd grab their board and kind of jump in their aerial. Tony couldn't do that because he was physically too weak. So he learned how to ollie. He would go up the side of the pool and go pop. And he'd pop the board and it would launch him. And as the board was growing up, then he would grab it. A lot of people said he was cheating. But what he had done is he invented the future. That's the most efficient way to do aerials.
Sure.
To kick your board, let it sail, then grab it. But when he invented it, they thought he was cheating because he couldn't do it their way.
Isn't that funny?
But eventually, that was the way everybody would eventually do it. So I could just see it. This kid's, it's going to be his time. And sure enough, it was. And about a year later, he won the Combi Bowl contest at Upland.
Which is such a hard pool
to skate. It's an incredibly difficult pool to skate. And it was as if, for him, it was like Luke Skywalker going to the Dark Star. It literally was, because that's where all his haters were. That's where all the people were that really disliked him.
The Albas.
Yeah, and he beat them on their course. He took them apart. And from that point forward, the rise of Tony Hawk, the reign of Tony Hawk began. It was amazing.
Well, it's interesting hearing you say that because, you know, you have a reputation of putting together that team that really you had the best talent. Paolo Peralta had the best talent, and you were kind of the guy. You were the guy that was able to assemble that. But I, you know, looking at it and hearing that Christian Hissoy story, I was wondering if there was anyone else that you wanted to sign but weren't able to.
I would have liked to have signed. I wish I would have worked with Neil Blender, just because I like Neil Blender. We were really good friends, and I always put him on my skate videos, but he worked for GNS, and I didn't want to take him from them.
Because you were a GNS guy.
Yeah, before. And I didn't want to take them, you know. And But I ended up working with him anyway, just be like friendly-wise. No, I pretty much got every guy that I wanted.
How did you lose Christian?
I think it was his dad's decision. They wanted things quicker than I wanted to make them happen. Mm-hmm. Christian wanted to turn pro, and I didn't want to turn him pro. I wanted him to wait one more year because I had a philosophy that if when a kid turns pro, he's got to really turn pro. He's got to get in the top three and let everyone know I'm here, and you're going to have to deal with me now. I'm going to make something of this where if they finish 8th or 10th or 12th, it's like, so what? They write you off because it's a game of perception. And like Steve Caballero listened to me. Tony listened to me. McGill listened to me. Wait a year. Become the best amateur you can be. And when you turn pro, you're going to go right into pro, and everyone's going to go, oh, my God, this guy's turning pro? Oh, no.
Right.
And that's what I tried to do that with all my guys. Because when you turn pro and make a big difference, you decimate people's perceptions. You screw with them. And that's not good. Another thing I would tell these guys is don't ever show up at a contest without a new maneuver. You have to show up with a new maneuver at every single contest because you want to tire your opponents out. You want them to know that you're not letting down, ever. And you're going to tire them out.
And was this the way you spoke to them as kids, too?
I mean, I tried to, but I wasn't hardcore.
No, but it's interesting because it is very, you know, like what you're saying. Is.
Yeah,
like,
but I was never in their face, like, you got it, but it was like,
no.
Come on. And they were, but I didn't have to say much to them. They were so self-motivated.
You picked very motivated guys.
They were very motivated, yeah. And guys that weren't motivated didn't work out on my team, unfortunately. I couldn't take a guy that wasn't motivated and make him motivated. It didn't work. And I had a lot of guys that didn't work.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, were there guys that had a lot of talent and they just didn't work hard enough?
They just didn't. They just, once they got the chance to really have what they thought they wanted, they didn't really want it.
Right.
So it didn't work out.
You made the first real skate video.
Mm-hmm.
The first Bones Brigade video was, I mean, it got me through my first year of college. And because that was 84, 85, and...
Spring of 84, we premiered it in Tony Hawk's parents' living room.
You did?
That's how small time it was. That's how little faith we had in it, how humble it was.
I went to college in September of 84 and had that video with me. And it snowed for 6 months straight in eastern Washington. And that I thought I'd made the worst decision in the world. And I watched that thing every single day.
Wow.
You know? Like, it was kind of a fight to get the VCR in the dorm room because it was a communal VCR.
Right.
But I, you know, when you did that, that was a brand new marketing tool.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also new technology, mm-hmm. pretty much,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to a whole film crew and an expensive.
It was pretty much the first time a person like me, a novice, could get a camera and have an editing bay in my apartment. And I could make a finished product in my apartment.
Did a light go on?
5 years like before that, that was not possible. Because it was the advent of 3/4-inch tape, U-matic tape. Before that, everything was 1-inch
sure.
or 2-inch, which was those gigantic pedestal cameras. This was the first time it was reduced to something smaller. But by today's standards, it was gigantic. Because the camera was big, uh-huh. and it was connected to a big recorder. The recorder and the camera were separate, you know, pieces.
That's right. There was a cable and there was a recorder. Uh-huh. It wasn't in the body.
So when I had to do moving camera work, I had to, and I also couldn't buy wide angle lenses. I had to buy wide angle adapters that I'd screw onto the front of my lens. So I had a Sony camera. I'd screw the wide angle adapter on. I had the recorder in a backpack and I'd skate with the camera, holding the camera, backwards, forwards, sideways, everything, getting moving shots.
Amazing. Yeah. And it really was just kind of you, right?
I mean, that's pretty much, I mean, Stesic was involved, but he wasn't shooting stuff or editing stuff. He was just there as an idea person, you know, and a co-conspirator.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I cut them all. I shot 90% of all of them.
You know? And when you did that, did a light bulb go on like, oh, this, I want to do this. Like, this is something, or was it just a means to an end? Like,
I wasn't that, I never had any confidence that I was any good. Like, when I figured out how to do it, I figured, well, if I can do it, anybody can do this. That's what I thought at first. But what happened is, after I did the first video, again, we thought we'd sell 3,000 copies of them. I think we sold something in the neighborhood of 30. Because what we didn't realize is that the VCR revolution was happening right then.
Right.
When I started shooting it, the VCR revolution hadn't happened. But by the time we released it, it did. Again, George came to me about 6 months after we released the first video, and he said, we're getting calls from all over the world from shops that have bought these things from us and from distributors. And they're saying that these videos, that everyone we sell gets into the hands of 50 kids. And that the videos are lifting the sport. Because kids are now seeing how to do it. When they look at a magazine, they'd see a maneuver, but they didn't understand how a kid got from there, here to there, or there to here. But when they saw the video, they saw the whole thing. So it completely revolutionized how kids consume skateboarding. And it really helped the sport grow. So George said, you're going to have to do this once a year now. You got to make a skateboard video every year now. It was never our intent.
Interesting.
And so he said, next spring, you have to have a new video. And I went, all right, I'll start working on it. And so Future Primitive was the next video next year. And what happened is after Future Primitive, I started getting offers in Hollywood to work as a second unit director because nobody could figure out how I was getting my moving shots.
Right.
They'd see these moving shots of kids skateboarding down New York through crowds of people, and they couldn't understand who was holding the camera. You can't get a dolly and do that stuff like that. You can't weave in and out of people, forwards and backwards. So I went and I'd meet these Hollywood executives in their offices, and they'd say, how'd you get those shots? And I said, well, I put my recorder on my back, and I hold the camera, and I skateboard. And they're going, no, come on, how did you get those shots? And they wouldn't believe me until I showed them.
So you had some jobs literally just on a skateboard filming other things, commercials and
Gleaming the
film.
Cube,
oh, really?
Thrashing, Police Academy 4, Hook with Steven Spielberg. And then there was commercials, you know, and how I got in the director's union.
No kid.
And then I started getting offers to do other things, directing comedy and all sorts of crazy stuff. Skate TV for Nickelodeon. Yeah, it was just, you know, and I was doing my skateboarding company and doing these film things. I was crossing both areas.
Well,
and I was slowly building my confidence that maybe I can do this. Maybe I can do this.
So was there a moment where you were looking at the future of staying as a partner at Palo Peralta or cutting that tie completely and going, I'm going to go be a director? Was that like a dark night of the soul?
Well, it was precipitated by some, you know, by changes that were occurring between George and I and how we saw the company and where he wanted to take it, where I wanted to take it. And we were really good partners building a business. But when it came to sustaining a business, we both had completely different ideas on how it should be done. And he owned more of the company, far more than I did. And it was his to take it whatever direction he wanted. I didn't agree with it. And so, I had some soul-searching moments to, like, untether myself from this and start fresh and do something new.
Looking back, do you feel like you would have done anything differently?
It was the best decision I ever made in my life. And I say that not because I started a new career. I say that because it's letting go of skateboarding was one of the most important things I ever did.
Why is that?
Because I felt I had done everything I wanted to do. And if I had stayed, I would have been staying for the money.
Uh-huh.
And I let it go. And I was strong enough to let it go. And to this day, it's the thing I'm most proud of. And what's so weird is it would eventually come back to me. The whole thing would come back to me.
Well, that's what I wanted
to
ask.
And I never searched it. I never reached out for it. I never thought I'd do it. It came back. So that's the most proud thing I've ever done. Yeah. I had the strength to say, I'm letting this go. The total security, a complete guaranteed future for something completely unknown.
Right, because at that point, you didn't walk away when there was another lull. Skateboarding was big when you walked away.
We had had our most successful Christmas ever. I left January of 1991. January of 90 was our most successful Christmas. It was big. Yeah, but it was time, it was time.
Right.
And I'd had a lot of influence. I'd had a lot of influence shaping the industry. And I felt it was time, man. Let the new blood have their say. I've had enough say here. I've done enough here. I was a part of the street skateboarding revolution, the backyard ramp revolution, and everything that came in the 80s, and my own generation. I've had a good run here. I don't need to do this anymore.
It is a bold move, though, because...
It was my identity.
Yeah, your whole identity since
you were a
kid.
Yeah, it was my whole identity.
And you were a celebrity in that world. You were a figurehead. You were, you couldn't go anywhere in the skateboard world without being, oh, there's Stacy Pearl.
Yeah, so, and when I went into the film business, I went in without that identity or that persona, because at that time, it wasn't cool to be somebody else if you were going to be in film. Like, nowadays, it kind of is.
Sure.
It wasn't back then. I didn't want people to know I had done that.
Really?
So I didn't share it at all. I'd be doing a production. I remember doing a production for a company, a television show, a company that I did a lot of work for. We were in Sherman Oaks. They had buildings. And somebody had brought in Glenn Friedman's book,
right.
The Hero's book.
Sure.
And they're going, hey, you're in this book. You're in this book. We didn't know about this about you. It's like, oh, I just didn't share that stuff. Because I wanted to do this in a sense alone. I wanted to make this new thing. If I had anything in me, I wanted to succeed on my ability and not on what I had been.
And I'm sure there's enough examples in the skate world of guys who hung on too long.
Oh my God. Not only hung on too long, it's like, guys, you leave. Leave. Make room for somebody else here. Yeah, there's a lot of people like that.
Well, it didn't.
And it gets tiring. It's tiring to see that.
Yeah.
It's stale. Anyways.
What year did you do Dogtown and Z-Boys?
I made that in 2000. We premiered at Sundance 2001.
So you had a 10-year break before...
Struggle.
A 10-year struggle.
Struggle. Totally. I went eight or nine years. I did a lot of work. I directed a lot of TV. But as I directed more and more, the projects I was getting were getting worse and worse and worse.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was just awful. Awful. I was getting to the point where they were asking me to copy things I'd done 10 years previously. It was killing me. I wrote 5 screenplays at that time. I wrote and directed a number of pilots, okay? I wrote and directed a number of sizzle reels. I wrote and directed a number of short films. Everything I did, every single thing I did, ended up in a landfill.
So you didn't have a... It was kind of a directionless thing or trying a lot of different
things. No, I was working very hard on trying to support myself doing television, mm-hmm. but I wanted to make it as a filmmaker. And when I finally made it, when I finally got my film into Sundance, it took me 9 years to become an overnight success.
Did you have a moment where you said, wait a minute, I'm sitting on this great story and no one can tell it better than me? Or did someone, did it... get suggested to you?
It was always in the back of my mind. I thought I had a hunch it was a good story, but I thought of it more as a feature than a documentary. But what happened is that Spin Magazine had done an article in 1999 called Skateboarding's Founding Fathers, Founding Fathers. It was all about Dogtown. That article was bought by a number of Hollywood producers who were then going to make the feature film. And when that happened, I realized, oh my God, this story that I wanted to tell, that's my life, has been bought from me.
Right.
Like, bought out from under me. I can't even do it now. And that was one of the lowest points of my life, because my career had been just in the toilet at that point. And I remember taking a walk in Malibu one day, and I got to the top of this mountain, and I went, wait a minute, I'll make the documentary. Let Hollywood make the feature film. I'll do the documentary. And I literally ran down the mountain, got on my computer, and started writing the treatment that evening.
And had you thought documentary before then?
No, I don't recall. I don't recall, no.
So
I might have, but I can't remember. I was really thinking feature. I'd written five, you know, feature screenplays. I had ideas for so many more I wanted to write. That's where my head was at. I wasn't thinking, you know, documentary. And when we made Dogtown, I've said this before, but Sam, we had absolutely no faith that this was going to have any success whatsoever. None whatsoever.
I think that's the first doc experience, though. No matter what you do, it's like you feel like you're in such a vacuum and you're going to finish it and no one's going to care, right?
But I didn't think anybody would care. It's like, who's going to want to see this?
It's so funny.
Who's going to want to see a bunch of middle-aged guys talk about their skateboarding days?
So you know, tell me about Sundance, that experience.
Well, what happened is this fellow filmmaker friend of mine named Modi, a woman who's a fellow filmmaker, she came in to see the film one day, a rough cut. And when the cut was over, she said, I need to talk to you about something. And she took me outside. She goes, what's the date today? And I go, it's August something. She goes, you got to submit this to Sundance and you have time. Yeah, your submission is to the end of September. I said, I'm not doing that, Modi. N-O. She's going, why? And I said, because I don't want the disappointment. I'm not going to make this film and have the very first thing I do with it be a disappointment of somebody saying no.
Really?
And she goes, you have to do this. They're going to love this film. And I said, I won't do it. I am done with disappointment. Look, man, I had submitted all my screenplays to festivals and I had had so many no's and so many doors slammed. I couldn't take another one. Couldn't take it.
No kidding.
So she wouldn't leave me alone, though. She kept badgering me, took me to lunch and said, you have to do this. So I finally went in one day and I talked to Aggie, my producer, and Paul, my editor, and said, look, Modi keeps badgering me about this thing. What do you think? And they said, well, what do we have to lose? I said, all right, shoot, fine. So we did.
And then cut to winning the audience award, right?
We got in. But then this guy that worked for Digital Domain, this friend of ours, heard about us getting in, and he took us to lunch. He took us to lunch to kind of bring us down. Yeah. And he said, listen, I want to tell you something. We're all really happy for you guys. You got your film in Sundance. That's really, really good. But let me just tell you something. There's a reality to this whole thing. I'm going, what do you mean a reality? And he goes, you better get people to see your film at Sundance, because if no one sees your film's dead. And we're going, really? You mean people might not see it? He goes, oh yeah. He goes, you have to wear sandwich boards and come see our film and do all this stuff. And so we went to Sundance in abject fear, thinking that no one's gonna see our film because of what he told us. We didn't
really?
We thought just getting in there, they were gonna fill the theaters for us. We didn't realize you had to convince people. So we get there and our tails are between our legs and we walk up to, the first day we're there, we have to go to the sign-in registration. And there's all these really cool filmmakers there and we just feel like the dredges, man. It's like, how did we get here? We're standing in line and we're intimidated beyond belief. And finally it's our turn. The woman on the other side of the counter that works at Sundance says, okay, your name and film? And my name is Stacy Peralta. My film is Dogtown. She goes, Dogtown? I go, yeah, Dogtown and Z-Boys. She goes, your film is Dogtown? And I went, yeah. And she goes, oh, boy. And I just went, oh, no, there's already a problem. She's going, your film is completely sold out. All six screenings are sold out. I go, are you sure you have the right people in the right film? She goes, there is such a buzz about your film. Everybody wants to see it. Didn't expect that.
No kidding.
Last thing we expected. And they had to add extra screenings for press because so many people wanted to see it. It was a total hit. Won the Best Audience Award and won Director's Award. Yeah, so I went from complete obscurity to, finally establishing myself as something.
Wow, what a feeling that is to make something from your heart and have everyone respond in such a way, right?
Yeah, it was really nice, man. It was really nice. It was the first time in about 9 years that I had felt like I connected. You know, I had just come out of a divorce, which was like a disaster. My life was really, I thought my life was over. Before I made that film, I really was convinced that like, man, I'm gonna end up doing that thing that I've always tried to avoid, which is looking in my past as my high point of my life. It was a real low point.
But that's ironic that the next high point came from looking at your past, though.
Yes. Yeah.
No, but anyways,
but it was really amazing to walk up and down the street of Main Street, Park City, and have people that were not skateboarders come up and say, I saw your film and I loved your film. Even though I don't skateboard, it represented my childhood. And it was such a great thing to finally connect with people, to know that, God, I finally pulled this off, man. I finally did this thing I knew I could do, but that I had kept stumbling and not attaining.
Well, and I think that I remember when it came out, and the visual style was different than any doc that had, I think, come before it. Now it's very, very common to see, you know, this style. It was almost like you took Ken Burns and put him on a roller coaster or something, like finding the pictures and the quick camera moves. It was a really distinctive style right out of the gate for you. And was that something that was really conscious for
you? It was
a
lot of things. I usually don't go into things with pronunciations like it's going to be this way.
Right.
But I had done a lot of matte camera work in television shows, mm-hmm. and I never liked how steady it was, how clean it was. Start with the photograph and do the slow pan in. That stuff drove me nuts. And this was the first time I was able to tell the guys operating, just freestyle, throw photographs, move it this way, this way, this way. And then Paul, the editor, was taking this stuff and just adding so much dimension to it in his cutting, and it just kind of grew. And as it grew, we kept going, let's keep taking this further. Like, for instance, I did the temp track voiceover for Dogtown before Sean Penn did it. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a point when I did the temp track that I cleared my throat. Well, Paul just cut it in as a joke. And it was so funny. We liked it so much that I asked Sean Penn, would you clear your throat during that one line?
Really?
And he goes, no problem. It was stuff like that. It was just stuff that we were, as we were doing it, wow, that's cool. Do that again. Oh, that's, you know what? That's illegal to do. No, do it anyways. It was that type of thing. We found the film that way.
There was an irreverence to it.
Yeah, there was moments where, in order to not just jump cutting boring interviews, we'd speed them up. And you'd see the person speed up the bite. And we had burn marks and things and mm-hmm. all sorts of, but so what we did is we just, and then we started realizing, you know what? This is reflecting the subject matter. It's reflecting the subversive nature of this activity. So the film informed us what it wanted to be.
And
which is the best place you can be as an artist, when your project itself is telling you what it wants. At that point, you just become a servant.
Right, yeah.
That's the best part.
When you really feel like it's becoming its own entity.
Yes, yes.
Were you making up your process as you went along in terms of telling a documentary story? Or, in other words, did someone sit down with you and say, here's how you cut a documentary, or here's how you approach the assembly of all your material?
No, I had no idea.
So No idea. Were you making up methods that you still use to this day?
Yes, but I'd also learned a lot of methods just doing television. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not taught. I didn't go to school for this stuff, so I had to figure out ways to do things. And the way I cut Dogtown, the way we cut it, is I would just do one segment at a time. Let's just cut this segment. Let's just cut that randomly. This one from the back of the film, this from the front. Now, I had no idea how this was going to assemble, but once we got the pieces put together, and I said, I think this would go here, and this would go here, and, you know, and just started shaping it. And then what we did is we did shakedown screenings, brought friends in, take a look at the film, give us your notes. Tell us what's wrong with this. Mm-hmm. Please help us by telling us what's wrong. And we keep shaking it down until we got the order correct.
At what point did you write the voiceover?
Oh, I wrote the voiceover immediately.
Before you started editing?
No. Here's how Paul and I worked on Dogtown, is that I would lay out all the bytes in order on my computer. Mm-hmm. And whenever there was a need for a bridge, I'd write a piece of voiceover to connect the two bytes, the sequences. I then give those bytes to Paul, and he lays them down. He lays all the bytes down.
Uh-huh.
I lay the voiceover in. And then we listen to what's called the radio cut. Is it working just listening to it? Then once that was done, we would decide what music we're going to lay down. He lays down the music, opens up the bytes, fits the music in. Once the music's laid down, then you lay picture.
But you didn't have a written story of the whole film at the beginning.
No, not even close. No, not even close.
So you didn't have a, okay, this is kind of our story arc, this is our acts. You just kind of figured out that as you went along.
I know we need to talk about this. I know we need to talk about, I knew all my subjects. I knew all the chapters we needed to discuss. I just didn't know how it was going to work. Had no idea.
You know, it's interesting because in each one of your films, your documentaries, they've been very personal. And, you know, two of them are about skating, one's about surfing, and one is about the history of gangs in Los Angeles, which looks, until you look at it deeper, looks like the one that sticks out. But I remember watching Crips and Bloods and seeing the map that shows up, the graphic map, and you have the red areas blocked out. And it's generally like this oval shape from, say, USC down to Wilmington. But then there's this one blue square over in Venice. And right then I saw it and I said, oh, maybe I understand how this makes sense in your personal choices of what to make films about. Was some of that curiosity about Los Angeles gangs from your personal environment growing up?
Yeah, I went to Venice High School, and we had a number of race riots at the school. Mm-hmm. The West Side Crips went to Venice. Occasionally, Crips from South LA would come to Venice, and there'd be issues between the rival gangs. I remember one day going to school, and there were cops all out front. Cop comes up to me, he goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm walking to school. And he goes, don't bother going today. He goes, there's too much trouble. So I went surfing. You know, it was an issue. And growing up in LA, I was living in Los Feliz, the time of the 90s rebellion. Mm-hmm. And I saw it unfold, had a view from my house. I saw it unfold. And that riot rebellion, whatever you want to call it, really disturbed me. It really, really disturbed me because I thought, man, this is the second time this has happened in the same place within 30 years. Something's really wrong here. And at that time, kids were killing each other with AK-47s. And I just thought one day, I had this thought, like, if white kids in Brentwood were arming themselves with AK-47s and they were driving through neighborhoods in the Palisades and killing white kids who also were arming themselves with AK-47s, how long do you think that would last? A day? But why is it lasts long, you know, for years in the African-American community? And I just thought there's something wrong here, and so I wanted to investigate it.
Well,
that was it. It was just it. I just wanted to understand it.
And that was an idea that percolated for a long time.
Long time.
Because
long time.
To tell the story right, you went way far back. There's connections to every aspect of being an African American in the United States since slavery. And you bring that right up to the present, and you took your time with it. I think you're
right.
40 minutes in before you really
right.
get into...
The only thing I knew is I knew I couldn't start the film with all the history. I couldn't start the film that way. I had to start the film with a bang.
Right.
And then slowly go back in time, because if I would have started the whole thing like that, it would have lopsided the film. And so it was figuring out how to dip back into the past, come back in the present, dip back in the past, come back to the present, so that the audience understands that you're really watching a current film about something current, but we're going to give you some history on this. That was very tricky. That's the longest edit of any film that I've been on.
It was.
Yeah, I mean, I get all my films done in a year's time, but I was in the editing bay. That was a really tricky film to cut. Really tricky film. Hard film.
Were there times when you were scared making that film?
I was terrified. I was terrified the day I got approval that I was going to get to make it. Like the day I got the realization that the financing is going to come through with this film, I had this realization, like, what am I thinking? I can't do this. What the hell was I thinking?
Right.
And then I'd go into the hood and we'd shoot down there and it was scary. And when we would get home, I felt like when I was in my own neighborhood, I was on a movie set, because everything just operates so smoothly. It's a whole different world. It's a whole different world. Scared the crap out of me. I was worried about it all the time. It was heavy.
Yeah, it was a brave thing.
It was a heavy thing. But I also did it real smart in that everywhere I went with a shot caller. I went with somebody who had really high respect in that neighborhood, who allowed me to go there, who knew where to go and where not to go, and protected me. And so if there was trouble, he was a respected enough individual that he was going to shut any trouble down. And I would never go anywhere without a guy like that. And so before I even made that film, I went in, I got connections to certain people, and I drove into these neighborhoods myself, sat down, met these guys, said, this is who I am, this is where I'm from, this is what I want to do, and I'm asking for your help to make this film. And the fact that I did that without cameras or crews, person one-to-one, made the biggest difference ever, man. These guys looked at me and they said, man, where are you from? Because nobody does that with us. They come here, they tell us what they want, they bring their camera crews, they put them in our face, and they say, make trouble. And they go, the fact that you would treat us like a human being first and then come later with the cameras, they go, we'll do anything you want.
That is a lesson, I think, in how to approach any subject in any filmmaking environment, or just
you
how to approach anybody in any
you got to respect the people. You got to respect them. You have to respect their story, their environment, and how they operate in everything. And you have to really listen to them. And it was a life-changing experience. That's actually, strangely enough, I know this is going to sound weird. It's my most personal film.
Doesn't sound weird to me, and I'll tell you, some of the choices you made, I feel like some of your earlier films were preparing you for how to deal with that material.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
There's one moment when you have a graphic of Martin Luther King and a red circle comes up and there's a shotgun sound that punctuates what you're saying. And it was extremely like confrontational and direct. And, you know, you use a lot of graphic and audio elements to underscore the violence in that film.
Right.
And I thought that, you know, had you have not gone through that process with Dogtown and Riding Giants first and developing
I could have never made that. Yeah, could have never done that. One of the African-American professors that's in the film, a professor named Todd Boyd.
From USC.
Yeah, from USC. He saw an early cut of the film and I said to him, Todd, am I pushing this too hard? Am I hitting this too hard? And he goes, you have to do this. You have to hit it as hard as you can. Because people just don't believe this. So you have to unnerve them. So he was very helpful. A lot of people were very helpful, you know.
There's that montage of all the moms.
Yeah.
And, you know, in any other setting, I feel like that would have been too much.
Was it too much? Because I don't know. It might be.
No. I'll tell you, it wasn't. And
I worry
about
that.
You know, the camera's moving and they're portraits. Super bold choice, but I feel like that, you know, that's the moment in the film that got me the most.
Right.
Was seeing all these women who had to deal with, you know, generations of this and having their sons die, and it was heartbreaking, and yet it was you needed that.
Right. When we went to Sundance, I took about 5 former gang members with me up there.
Oh, you did?
And 2 of them had not seen the film. And they said when they saw that, they realized the destruction that they had caused. And it never connected with them that this is what they left. That the destruction they caused by shooting 4 other gang members, rivals, that they didn't realize that they were leaving their mothers to deal with this. And it really hit them very hard.
When the woman talks about asking the kids to raise their hands if they've had a family member or an uncle die.
Yeah.
I mean, that was...
It's heavy.
It was heavy.
It's heavy, man. It was heavy doing those interviews. It was not easy doing that.
I bet.
It was really tough.
Now, have you had any comments back since the film's been out from that neighborhood? Has there been any kind of,
Nothing but support. It's all been supportive. We showed it in the community many times, and so many people, former gang members, guys that have been in jail for years, said, man, this is my story. This is exactly what it was like for me growing up. Mothers were saying, it's finally somebody tells the truth. So they were very, very supportive, hugely supportive. It's now being shown in schools, colleges, you know, and whatnot. So it doesn't go down well with everybody. A lot of people were mad at me for making the film, saying that I overdid it, saying that that doesn't really happen, saying that, you know, I underlined it too much, which I may have, but, you know, I got sucked into it.
What did you take away from making that film?
In what way?
Well, it just, I guess...
Filmmaking-wise or culture-wise?
You know, the week after the Twin Towers went down, and you drove around on the roads, and if you made eye contact with some other guy, there was like sort of this...
Yeah, we're in this together.
Yeah, and now it's like, you know, you give someone a toot on their horn because the lights turned green 5 minutes ago, and he's on the phone, and then you get, you know... And I kind of walked away from your film a little bit with that. So I wondered what, if I had that experience just watching the film,
It made me realize that there really are two Americas in this country. There may be more than two, but those kids who are in gangs, who live in those neighborhoods, they live in a different America than the America that we live in. It's not the same country. It's not the same place. The school system is different. The whole way the city's designed is different. The community policing is different. It's a different world. And they are under pressures in ways that we will never comprehend or understand. They see things and hear things that are so foreign to our neighborhoods. And it's hurtful. It's sad. It's really hurtful. And it just makes me realize that there's a dishonesty, in a sense, to the way that we paint the American dream. It's a dream for a lot of people, but for a lot of others, it's not a dream at all. It's a bit of a nightmare. And it also has to do with the way we, structure our understanding of the history of this country. History of this country is brutal, man. And I'm an American, and I love being an American, and I'm proud to be. But we don't look at our history honestly, in an honest manner.
I agree completely.
If you just take slavery as one example, if you set that aside and you deal with the Jim Crow issue, oh my God, the cruelties that were imposed upon these people are unbelievable. Unbelievable. We don't deal with that. We don't deal with it in school. You don't learn the truth of it. So it's those things. But the beauty of this country is that you can bring these things up without having the government tell you not to. And that's so slowly but surely we get better and better.
Well, I did watch, there was a lot of pictures of kids in that film. And that's the heartbreaker right there, because we don't start out that way.
None of us do. Those kids, so often they spend so much of their time in survival mode, just wanting to survive being on the street. They get picked on so much that after a while they harden, they become angry, and then they start fighting back. And so the cycle just keeps repeating itself over and over. And then they're faulted for it on top of it. And then they're persecuted for it. So it's a self-generating mechanism.
Now that you've made four big theatrical documentaries, have you kind of defined a bit more in your own head what you're kind of searching for or what your voice is in filmmaking?
I'm at a bit of a crossroads. I don't know what I'm going to do next. And it's the first time I've been like that in 10 or 15 years. I don't know what's next. These films are really hard to make. They're hard to make. It's hard to get financing for them. It's really hard to make a living doing them. I made Bones Brigade for nothing. I didn't get paid a dime. That's 2 years of work in my life. It was the lowest budget of any film I've ever worked on. I had no crew. I had no offices. I made it with an editor and another producer. And we all worked out of our own homes. So it's tough.
Well, let's talk about that.
It's funny, because people see my films. They see Dogtown Riding Giants. They see these films on cable. They see them in theaters. They see them on airplanes. And there's this presumed idea that I'm making a fortune off these films. I don't make any money off of them. I'd love to, but I don't. I don't own my films. They're owned by Sony Classics and these other, film distribution companies. If anybody's making money, it's them. That's the way it is in the film business.
But I think that we're at this place now. I mean, let's talk about...
Yeah, so we did Bones Brigade differently because we self-released it through a new way with a company called Topspin. And Topspin is a company that's democratizing the distribution business for artists. They're allowing people like myself, people like yourself, to come in and retain ownership of our films, sell our films directly to the people who want our films, and we're able to profit off it and own the copyright and keep our films in perpetuity, which is a big deal.
So tell me the story of when you made Bones Brigade and you took it to Sundance and you were actually offered a traditional distribution deal, if I'm not...
Bones Brigade was accepted into Sundance 2012.
Okay.
January 2012. We had close to three offers. It looked like three offers, traditional offers, to distribute the film. we can sell to this company, company A, or company B, or company C. And they all presented different options to us. Ultimately, what all these people want is they want to sell our film on iTunes and DVD and video on demand. When they sell films like mine in theaters, they make no money. Most films do not make money in theaters, in theatrical release. All the theatrical release is for a film is a concert tour to promote the film. Mm-hmm. And the better it does in the theater, the higher the price that the cable companies will pay for that film. The more awareness there is for that film, which means there'll be more people buying it on iTunes, which means Netflix will give you a bigger price for the film. That's why you want to be in theaters. Most people don't understand this. We realize that theater isn't important to us for this film. Although we did our own theatrical run, it was small, it was good, it was what we needed, but we sold directly through Netflix, iTunes, video on demand, and everything. And we sold off our site through the Top Spin program. Top Spin set up our whole program. What they do is they have this way of taking any fan that I have all around the world, any fan Tony Hawk has, Steve Caballero, Lance Mountain, and combining all of our fans into one website and selling directly to them.
So you were able to say no to a distribution deal?
I was able to say no to the traditional distribution model and say, I appreciate your offer, but I'm not going to take it, thank you, and do a different model that has now been developed. And this wasn't available 5 years ago, and it's now available. And I think what's going to happen is it's only going to get better as the years progress.
So that's what I feel. Was there a moment when you said, I'm actually going to say no to this? I'm actually going to...
I knew I was going to say no to it before I went to Sundance, because I had... one of the guys that runs Topspin, his name is Bob... I call him Bob Mose. His last name is Bob Mogilzadowski or something. I don't know. He's a great guy. I saw him speak on a panel discussion in San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly. He's one of the most impressive people I've ever seen speak in my life about really answering filmmakers' problems with distribution. Like, he really had an answer. He had solid answers that weren't airy-fairy. It was real, and it was hardcore, and it was tangible. And I went, I need to work with this guy. We had dinner that night. We met at Sundance in 2012. I said, let's do this. And he believed in the film and wanted to do it, so he took us on. And it was great. It was a really great experience because we kept control of it. We did it our way. And we were also interacting with our fans as they were seeing the film, coming up to seeing the film, the whole thing. There was talking back and forth through Twitter, through Instagram, through our website, through everything. It was a real-time experience.
And what does that open up for you for future films?
If I end up making money on this film, it shows me that I can sustain myself as a filmmaker. I can actually make films and make a living doing it so I can sustain myself to do the next film. And so, I can make it profitable for the people who back my films and also the people who work on my films. I've always been a very independent person. I prefer doing things independently. I prefer doing things without the studios as much as I can, without the agencies and all that stuff. I'd rather do it myself.
I think we're at an interesting time where the technology exists and the distribution channels exist that it really is, it's open.
It's totally open now.
I mean, you can choose to spend a lot of money, but you can also choose to really go guerrilla and still make a very affecting film for not a lot of money.
Here's Bob. Bob at Topspin says it like this. He goes, if you're Justin Bieber, you actually need a big studio behind you. You need that. You need the muscle. If you're Steven Spielberg, you need the muscle of a worldwide-based studio. But if you're a filmmaker like myself, who's much smaller, I don't need that big studio like that. I can do it a different way, and those distribution tools are now available to people like me. It was just like when I started making the very first skateboarding video. I was able to get an editing system in my apartment. 5 years prior to that, I couldn't have. But now I could. It's the same thing now. I can distribute the film myself. I don't even have to leave my house. That's a big paradigm shift. And if I can do it now, in 5 years, 10 years, it's going to be so much better. They're going to figure this thing out and make it such a better system.
After Dogtown and Z-Boys, you wrote then the narrative version of Dogtown and Z-Boys, which became Lords of Dogtown, which is interesting because when you said you made the documentary, your impetus was, I'm going to tell the real story because the story of that had been bought by the studios. But as it turns out, you made this film before anyone else was far enough down the road, right?
Right, that's right.
So you're able to write it. Was there ever a discussion that you would direct it?
There was. I was loosely considered, but never heavily. You know, it was a loose consideration. I never pushed myself. I never, ever sold myself on that possibility. I wasn't eager to do it.
But they came to you as, you have to write this? Or how did it work?
What happened was, they were looking for screenwriters to write that. And you know how long it takes for things to happen in Hollywood.
Sure.
The screenwriter they had chosen ended up having a TV show of his cell, CSI. Huh. So he was gone. So suddenly there was no writer. I made my film. They saw my film and went, wow, this is really good. This guy really captured this thing. And so I started talking to John Linson, who was the primary producer of the film. We hit it off. And I think he felt that I would be an easy gamble because I knew the subject. I showed him some of my original screenplays that I wrote, so he knew I could write. And so I think he thought that if I did it, it would help just the learning curve. They don't have to teach a screenwriter about the whole world.
Right.
But I never actually finished the screenplay.
You didn't?
I wrote it to a certain point, and then David Fincher, who was also a producer on the film, at one point was going to direct it. So he took the film and he brought another screenwriter in to start working on it. I don't exactly know what happened, but I believe from what I've been told that they took it a different direction. That direction didn't necessarily work. And then he left the project. So they went back to my screenplay. They went through a bunch of other channels. They finally got Catherine Hardwick to direct it. She put a tremendous amount of work into the screenplay and rewrote a lot of stuff. So it was one of those things, you know, typical Hollywood situation where it just keeps morphing with different hands.
And did you have any part in the casting?
Oh, no, I had nothing to do with it. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't ask to have anything to do with it. That wasn't my place. It was Catherine's film. It's up to her. It's John Linson's production. It's up to them. If they want my help, I'll give them my help, but that was their thing.
Right.
I was not going to interrupt in any way, shape, or form.
And what did you take away from watching your documentary get turned into...
It was hard. It was a really hard thing. It was a really, everybody got involved. Tony Alva, Jay Adams, Craig Stasek, Skip M. Everybody was involved. Everyone gave it their best. It was a really hard thing. It was a hard thing. It was a hard thing to see the Hollywoodized story of Dogtown. To see the... It was a tough experience.
Yeah.
It was a tough experience.
Was there, even with your film and with Lords of Dogtown, is there still a misconception that you can think of that still maybe exists about that time or something that maybe you felt you didn't capture in your film about that time? Or do you feel like your film really is the definitive
I think Dogtown and Z-Boys captures enough about the time to give people a sense of what it is. Could I have become more personal in my storytelling as a filmmaker? Oh, totally. Had I made Dogtown and Z-Boys today, it would have been a much more personal film. I would have got much more involved. It would have been much more like the Jay Adams sequence with a number of the guys.
Uh-huh.
But I was a much less mature filmmaker then. I like to think I'm a little better now. I hope to think I'm better at storytelling.
Right.
You know, like for instance, Bones Brigade, which is a film I didn't want to make, but I made it. There's no voiceover in the film. It's the first time I've never had voiceover in a documentary. That was a big step for me. It was the first time I made a much more personal film about the characters. That was a big deal for me. You know, I'm pleased with what I did. I learned a lot making that film. I worked with a different editor on that film, Josh Altman, and I learned a lot from him. He's a young editor who's really, really, really good. And he taught me a lot about storytelling.
And did that start as a challenge, like let's try to make this without voiceover?
Yeah, I did want to make it without voiceover. So I worked my ass off on my questions so that I'd have everything covered so I wouldn't have to rely on voiceover. And I also, you know, worked like I normally do on, you know, my interview style and how to get the best out of it.
And how did those characters that were in the film, Steve Caballero and Lance and Rodney, and how did they end up receiving the film? And you know,
oh, they
love
it.
They saw it.
They're the ones that wanted the film. They had been badgering me for about 8 years to make it. They wanted it. They felt they had a legacy that was worth telling. They liked what I had done with Dogtown, and they just kept at me year after year. Come on, make this, please, make this. And I said, no, I can't make another film where I'm a character in it. I'm going to be assassinated by critics. I really thought I was going to be dragged over the coals. So, anyways, in 2011, Lance called me and he said, look, we are now older than you and Tony Alva were when you made Dogtown. We're older than you guys. And I went, all right, I'll do it. So that's how it happened.
It's interesting,
and also I just said, screw the critics, screw the perception in Hollywood that I can only make, you know, action sports. It doesn't matter anymore. I just don't care. I stopped caring about the whole thing. I'm simply going to do what I've always done, which is make what I want to make. Screw the career, screw the whole thing.
Well, we talked a little bit about that, and I wanted to bring that up because what I was getting to in watching, you know, not only you watching Dogtown and Z-Boys be made into a narrative Hollywood film, but some of the struggles that you've told me about in trying to operate in that world after having the success of
in the Hollywood films. Feature world.
Exactly.
Yes.
Because a lot of doors opened for you, did they not,
yes.
after?
Well, the doors opened for me to enter, but no checkbooks followed.
Right.
There were
no checkbooks opened.
Yeah, nor were there opportunities, just doors opened to meet people. But what happened was I wrote a number of screenplays for other companies, and I found that I'm not of that material to work in that business.
What does that mean?
I found that I wasted so much time writing screenplays for other people, for other companies, for other entities. I went to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting. And I just found that when I assessed the last 10 years of my life, and I went, how many films did I get done that were my own? And how many films did I get done when I did it the Hollywood way? It was like 5-1. And I decided this is a waste of time. I don't like working in this field. I don't like the system. I don't like how it operates. But whenever I want to get a film done, it takes me roughly 6 months to get the money. It takes me a year to make the film and a year to release the film. And it's done. I have a film, a tangible film that is made my way.
Right.
So I relinquish the big money and the big theatrical release for doing it a different way. But at the end of the day, I have a new film on the shelf. And that's what I want.
So was there,
and I want to do
was
it myself.
Another conscious moment for you where you said, screw it, I'm walking away from that dream of the big, giant narrative feature? Or?
Yes. It happened right before I did Bones Brigade. I had been writing something for a very famous actor who's still a friend of mine and someone I care for greatly. But I just spent too much time on a project that he wanted, and it was just too much time. I wasted so much psychic energy of mine with my writing partner trying to make this story that this particular guy wanted. And we couldn't do it. And I just realized I'm taking too much of what I have up here and devoting it to this thing over here that's leading me nowhere. I don't want to do this anymore. It's a waste of time.
What was the feeling like when you made the decision?
I didn't have one of those.
It wasn't like...
Nah, it wasn't like the light opened the sky. It's like, yes, you've done it, you know. But it's just that every decision you make is a lonely one. I hate to say that. It's a lonely one. This is a lonely business. It really is. It's lonely being an artist. It's part of the process. It's a lonely thing because you have to live with these ideas that you get that make no sense when you first get them. And you have to gestate with these ideas. And I've learned not to share my ideas with people early on because I never get the feedback I want.
Right.
And when I don't get the feedback I want and I'm not careful, it can corrode my belief in that idea. So I have to hold on to these ideas by myself, silently, and have the strength to develop it by myself because otherwise I'll corrode it. Ideas are very, very, man, here's what I believe. Tell me if I'm getting too lofty here.
No, please.
Okay. You know how viruses travel through the atmosphere?
Sure.
They're microscopic. And we take them in. All a virus is looking for is an able host. It's looking for a nice, warm body. the flu virus, this tiny microscopic thing is looking to land on you because it wants to grow inside of you. Ideas travel through the subconscious the same way. They're looking for a host. That's how we get, they're looking for something. Ideas come to us. But the problem is too many of us are impatient with them. They need time to grow and develop, because when they first hit us, they hit us as a reflection or a shard or a piece or a hint. It's a piece of a dream, but it's not the whole dream. And it takes time to develop that whole dream, but you have to sit with it alone. You have to sit with the fever and let it devour you until you finally go, oh, I've got this. I see, right, I know where this needs to go now. It takes time, it's lonely, and it's insecure. You're insecure so much of the time.
No, it's true. It's like, can you imagine being a novelist and sitting with an idea for a book?
This, exactly. You're sitting with this the whole time.
No, and it's true. I've had that same thing where I've got this idea and I tell it to somebody.
Because you
want feedback. And the minute I tell them, they're like, oh, like this thing, or that'll never work. I've learned exactly like you to get so protective about the ideas.
You have to.
And especially working with someone else, the intermediary always wants to pass your idea on to them.
Yeah.
And I've learned to say absolutely not.
Because
you can't pass it with the same amount of conviction I have.
Absolutely.
And I am hanging on with, like, I don't have enough conviction either.
That's right.
You know?
I have young filmmakers ask me, they go, you know, I don't have the confidence I feel like I need. And I tell them, you don't need confidence at all. All you need is the ability to wake up and do what you want to do and love it. That's it. That's what I have. I have inertia. I have momentum that I generate. Confidence, man, that comes in time. That takes time to develop.
Yeah.
Really a lot of time. It's taken me a lot of time to develop that.
In going through these, you know, these films and through this whole process and writing so many projects, have you kind of identified some of your weaknesses or shortcomings that, like, what would you say?
I don't think I have any shortcomings. I'm kind of like Dick Cheney.
Really?
Pretty much everything I do is...
It's funny, I was just saying to a friend of mine, Stacy's coming over tomorrow, he's kind of like Dick Cheney.
Oh my God, shortcomings, where do we start, Sam?
No, I have too many. You know, I have my Achilles heels that I, now that I'm older, I can actually identify them, whereas I couldn't do that when I was younger.
Man. Yeah, I have a lot of shortcomings that I'm constantly dealing with. I'm constantly trying to be better at what I'm doing, constantly. I'll tell you one shortcoming I had. I direct TV commercials, and that's how I make a living. It took me a long time to really figure out this medium, and one of the things that I had a hard time dealing with is I have to take an idea that someone else thought up, and I have to figure out a way to own that idea. That was really hard for me. I'm used to thinking up my own ideas, living with my own ideas, and bringing them forth. But now I've got to take someone else's concept, respect that person, but make it my own. And it took me 2 or 3 years of really struggling and wanting to quit to do that, to develop that. I constantly am working on getting a better eye, developing an eye. I constantly have to keep working. How can I shoot this better? What's the proper lens? Really work on that.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I'm very collaborative when I work. Very, very collaborative. To me, my job as a director, when I work with people like an editor or a DP, my job is to make them the best they can be. Mm. It's not necessarily to do the best. My best is making them best. So when I get a DP, it's like, man, show me what I'm not seeing here. Make this shot better than I can think of. And when they do, I'm in heaven. Editors, same way. I want them to show me what I'm not thinking. I want to be surprised by what they do. And the better I can make them, the better I'm going to be. It's what I did with Tony Hawk, Steve Caballero. I put my ego aside. You be the best you can. That way I'll be the best.
See, but that's interesting, because going way back to your skate video work, you knew exactly where to put the camera to showcase that trick or that move.
But they're pretty simple camera moves. It's not. I wasn't inventing anything.
Right, but you're putting the camera in the right place.
But it's pretty simple.
Well, because you know the world.
I didn't get fancy.
You know the world.
Yeah, I wanted to simply show it as it is. Mm-hmm. It was pretty nuts and bolts.
Right.
You know, I didn't. I, and plus, I was shooting with video. I didn't have access to lenses at all. Sure. That's the one thing. That three-quarter was such an ugly format.
Don't you wish you could go back and make those films with what we have now?
I wish I could go back and make Animal Chin the way it should have been. In fact, that's something that would be funny to redo. But anyways, no.
I'm sensing the next chapter.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to redo. No, I'm just kidding. Anyways, but to go back to your thing, though, and I really work hard not to club myself over the head for what I do wrong.
Really?
That's always been a thing that I've really struggled with, is, you know, getting on myself. You could have been better. You could have been this. You should have done that. Da 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 da. All that negative crap in here. I work really hard on that, man. I meditate. I read books. I work with tools to stop that nonsense.
So you have a heavy self-critic.
Oh my God, horrible.
What is that about? I mean, because there is a value to having a heavy self-critic when it comes to pushing yourself to make your best work.
Yeah.
But at some point, there should be some switch we could turn off to give ourselves a break.
It doesn't work like that.
Isn't it funny?
There's no switch up here. This thing was designed. This is what I've discovered. Our brains were designed to just keep going like this. And if we want to stop it, we have to train it. And there's ways to do it. There's ways to train your mind to cool it. It's like Buddhism. It's mindfulness. And that's really what I'm working on.
Are you still skating?
I am. Yeah, still skating. I surf. Surfing's a huge part of my life. I mean, it's a huge part of my life. And skateboarding is as well, always will be.
And is the self-critic, does it subside when you're doing those things?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, because those things are so physical and they're spiritual. You know what I mean? And also, I'm not one of these skateboarders, these guys that when I go to the park, I have to prove that I can still do what I did when I was 18. I have no issues like that. No. I do what I can do now, and I do what I can do now really well. And I'm totally good with that. I don't need to prove anything to anybody in that regard. And in fact, I think I told you this at lunch. I'm starting to skateboard like I skateboarded as a kid, which is I ride a little board and I gyrate down sidewalks because I want to skateboard like I did as a kid.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think it's for spiritual reasons. I just want to go back to that route. Not that I won't skate parks, but I want to get that thrill I got doing it in the most simplified form. No tricks, just gyrating it. And I do it because at my age, it's amazing exercise.
Right.
Like really amazing. Like it's heart out of your chest exercise. But I want to go back to that. But I learned something really interesting. I don't enjoy it as much as I did as a kid when I skateboarded down the street. And I realized when I was a kid riding down the street, in my mind, I was surfing. So it was very imaginative. Every time I skateboarded, it was imaginative. It's not as imaginative now. And I have to bring my imagination back to it. That's a really profound realization for me. I realized, wow, this has so much to do with the enjoyment of it, what I'm thinking it is. Do you know what I mean?
You want to know what I did when I was a kid and was going down the street? You know what I imagined? Imagine I was you. It's a confession that I'm just going to make right here, that when I was, you know,
well,
7 years
compliment.
Old, or 8 years old,
compliment.
And it was 72, like, that was what I was imagining. Mm. And, you know, having you doing this with me on
that's
the show
really
and
cool.
Everything, it's such an honor for me to have you.
Well, I'm imagining myself being you right now.
Well, that's not going to look as good. Not as stylish.
That's cool, Sam. That's sweet.
You know what? It really is something that was a big part of my life. And, you know, the fact that we both went into similar pursuits,
man.
And everything, it's an honor for me. And it's also just really inspiring to have these conversations and know that you go through the same things. And that life is long. And you've had this entire life as a professional skateboarder. And then this life as a team owner, and then this life as a documentary filmmaker, and you have another one coming, you know, and what is that going to be? And I think as we get older, we can decide what that next thing is going to be, mm-hmm. a little bit better. So you're in that place right now where your mindset is you don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah, I've learned that at this day and age, man, it's all about paying attention and listening. Listening is the most important thing. You got to listen. You know, it's so important to listen. And listen really to what's coming to you. I believe we're all like receivers. like, you know, stereo receivers. And what our job is to get rid of the noise so that we can get the incoming signals. Because the signals are coming at us all the time. And so we just have to calm down, slow down, quiet down, and listen. And I know, I've been around long enough to know now, that if I do that, I'll go the right direction. I know what it feels like when I'm being told to go a specific way. I know those feelings, and it's about being quiet.
Seeing you and seeing your success is, it's in a way, I'm like a mentor from afar. I can watch what you've done, and I hope you keep doing cool stuff, because I'm gonna pay close attention.
Thanks, dude.
Have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.